Mr. Secretary? Adler looked up. Let me guess, this one is Clark, and this one is Chavez. You might even have a future in the intelligence business, John smiled. Handshakes were exchanged. Good morning, sir, Chavez said. Foley says with you my life is in good hands, Sexstate offered, closing his briefing book. He exaggerates. Clark walked a few feet to get a Danish. Was it nerves? John asked himself. Ed and Mary Pat were right. This should be a routine operation, in and out. Hi, how are you? Eat shit and die. So long. And he'd been in tighter spots than Tehran in 1979-80. Not many, but some. He frowned at the pastry. Something had brought the old feeling back, the creepy, crawly sensation on his skin, like something was blowing on the hairs there, the one that told him to turn around and look real hard at things. He also tells me you're on the SNI team, and I should listen to you, Adler went on. At least he seemed relaxed, Clark saw. The Foleys and I go back some, John explained. You've been there before?
Yes, Mr. Secretary.
Clark followed with 2 minutes of explanation that earned a thoughtful nod from the senior official. Me too. I was one of the people the Canadians snuck out. Just showed up a week before. I was out apartment hunting when they seized the embassy. Missed all the fun, Sexstate concluded. Thank God.
So you know the country some?
Adler shook his head. Not really. A few words of the language. I was there to learn up on the place, but it didn't work out, and I branched off into other areas. I want to hear more about your experiences, though.
I'll do what I can, sir, John told him.
Then a young captain came in to say that the flight was ready. A sergeant got Adler's things. The CIA officers lifted their own bags. In addition to 2 changes of clothes, they had their sidearms. John preferred his Smith & Wesson, Ding liked the Beretta 40, and compact cameras. You never knew when you might see something useful. Bob Holtzman had a lot to think about as he sat alone in his office. It was a classic newsman's place of work, the walls glass, which allowed him a modicum of acoustic privacy, while also letting him see out into the city room and the reporters there to see in. All he really needed was a cigarette, but you couldn't smoke in the post building anymore, which would have amused the hell out of Ben Hecht. Somebody'd got to Tom Donner and John Plummer. It had to be Keelty. Holtzman's views on Keelty were an exact mirror image of his feelings toward Ryan. Keelty's political ideas, he thought, were pretty good, progressive and sensible. It was just the man who was useless. In another age, his womanizing would have been overlooked, and, in fact, Keelty's political career had straddled those ages, the old and the new. Washington was full of women drawn to power like bees to honey, or like flies to something else, and they got used. Mainly they went away sadder and wiser. In the age of abortion on demand, more permanent consequences were a thing of the past. Politicians were so charming by nature that most of the cookies, that euphemism went way back, even went away with a smile, hardly realizing how they'd been used. But some got hurt, and Keelty had hurt several. One woman had even committed suicide. Bob's wife, Libby Holtzman, had worked that story, only to see it lost in the shuffle during the brief conflict with Japan. And in the interim, the media had decided in some collective way that the story was history, and Keelty had been rehabilitated in everyone's memory. Even women's groups had looked at his personal behavior, then compared it with his political views, and decided that the balance fell one way and not another. It all offended Holtzman in a distant way. People had to have some principles, didn't they? But this was Washington. Keelty had got to Donner and Plummer, and must have done so between the taped morning interview and the live evening broadcast, and that meant... Oh, shit, Holtzman breathed, when the light bulb flashed on in his head. That was a story. Better yet, it was a story his managing editor would love. Donner had said on live TV that the morning tape had been damaged. It had to be a lie. A reporter who lied directly to the public.
There weren't all that many rules in the business of journalism, and most of them were amorphous things that could be bent or skirted. But not that one. The print and TV media didn't get along all that well. They competed for the same audience, and the lesser of the two was winning.
Lesser? Holtzman asked himself.
Of course. TV was flashy, that was all, and maybe a picture was worth 1,000 words, but not when the frames were selected with an eye more towards entertainment than information. TV was the girl you looked at. The print media was the one who had your kids. But how to prove it? What could be sweeter? He could destroy that peacock with his perfect suits and his hairspray. He could cast a pall over all television news, and wouldn't that boost circulation? He could couch it all as a religious ceremony on the altar of journalistic integrity. Wrecking careers was part of his business. He'd never broken a fellow reporter before, but there was an anticipatory delight in drumming this one out of the core.
But what about Plummer? Holtzman knew and respected him. Plummer had come to TV at a different time, when the industry had been trying to gain respectability, and hired journalistic craftsmen on the basis of their professional reputations rather than their movie star looks. Plummer had to know. And he probably didn't like it.
Ryan couldn't not see the Colombian ambassador. The latter he saw was a career diplomat from the aristocracy, immaculately dressed for a meeting with the American chief of state. The handshake was strong and cordial. The usual pleasantries were exchanged in front of the official photographer, and then it was time to talk business.
"Mr. President," he began formally, "my government has instructed me to inquire about some unusual allegations in your news media."
Jack nodded soberly.
"What do you wish to know?"
"It has been reported that some years ago the United States government may have invaded my country. We find this assertion disturbing, not to mention a violation of international law and various treaty relationships between our two democracies."
"I understand your feelings on the matter. In your position, I would feel much the same way. Let me say now that my administration will not countenance such action under any circumstances. On that, sir, you have my personal word, and I trust you will convey it to your government."
Ryan decided to pour the man some coffee. He'd learned that such small personal gestures were vastly powerful in diplomatic exchanges, for reasons he didn't quite understand, but was quite willing to accept when they worked for him. It worked this time, too, and broke the tension of the moment.
"Thank you," the ambassador said, lifting his cup.
"I believe it's even Colombian coffee," the president offered.
"Regrettably, not our most famous export product," Pedro Ochoa admitted.
"I don't blame you for that," Jack told his visitor.
"Oh?"
"Mr. Ambassador, I am fully aware that your country has paid a bitter price for America's bad habits. While I was at CIA, yes, I did look over all manner of information concerning the drug trade and the effects it's had in your part of the world. I had no part at all in initiating any improper activity in your country, but yes, I did look over a lot of data. I know about the policemen who've been killed. My own father was a police officer, as you know. And the judges and the journalists. I know that Colombia has worked harder and longer than any other country in your region to bring about a true democratic government. And I will say one more thing, sir. I am ashamed at some of the things that have been said in this city about your country. The drug problem does not begin in Colombia, or Ecuador, or Peru. The drug problem starts here, and you are as much a victim as we are. Actually, more so. It's American money that's poisoning your country. It is not you who hurts us. It is we who hurt you." Ochoa had expected many things from this meeting, but not this. He set his cup down, and his peripheral vision suddenly reported that they were alone in the room. The bodyguards had withdrawn. There wasn't even an aide to take notes. This was unusual. More than that, Ryan had just admitted that the stories were true. Partly true, anyway.
"Mr. President," he said,
in English learned at home and polished at Princeton. We have not often heard such words from your country.
You're hearing them now, sir.
Two very level pairs of eyes crossed the table.
I will not criticize your country unless you deserve it, and on the basis of what I know, such criticism is not deserved. Diminishing the drug trade most of all means attacking the demand side, and that will be a priority of this administration. We are now drafting legislation to punish those who use drugs, not merely those who sell them. When the Congress is properly re-established, I will press hard for passage of that legislation. I also wish to establish an informal working group composed of members of my government and yours to discuss how we may better assist you in your part of the problem, but always with full respect for your national integrity. America has not always been a good neighbor to you. I can't change the past, but I can try to change the future. Tell me, might your president accept an invitation so that we could discuss this issue face to face? I want to make up for all this lunacy.
I think it likely that he would view such an invitation favorably, with due consideration for time and other duties, of course.
Which meant, damned right he will.
Yes, sir, I am myself learning just how demanding such a job can be. Perhaps, Jack added with a smile, he might give me some advice.
Less than you think.
Ambassador Ochoa was wondering how he'd explain this meeting to his government. Clearly the basis of a deal was on the table. Ryan was offering what could only be seen in South America as an elaborate apology for something that would never be admitted, and whose full revelation could only damage everyone involved. And yet this was not being done for political reasons, was it?
Was it?
Your proposed legislation, Mr. President, what will you seek to accomplish?
We're studying that now.
For the most part, I believe people use drugs because it's fun. Escape from reality, whatever you might want to call it. It comes down to personal amusement of one sort or another. Our data suggests that at least half of the drugs sold in the country are for recreational users rather than true addicts. I think we should make the use of drugs unfun, by which I mean some form of punishment for any level of possession or intoxication. Obviously, we do not have the prison space for all the drug users in America, but we do have lots of streets that need sweeping. For recreational users, 30 days, for the first offense, of sweeping streets and collecting garbage in an economically disadvantaged area, wearing distinctive clothing, of course, will take much of the fun out of it.
You are Catholic, I believe.
Yes, I am, as you are.
Ryan grinned. Then you know about shame. We learned it in school, didn't we?
It's a starting place. That's all it is for the moment. The administrative issues need to be looked at. Justice is also examining some constitutional questions, but those appear to be less troublesome than I expected. I want this to be law by the end of the year. I've got 3 kids, and the drug problem here frightens the hell out of me at the personal level. This isn't a perfect response to the problem. The truly addicted people need professional help of one sort or another, and we're now looking at a variety of state and local programs for things that really work. But hell, if we can kill off recreational use, that's at least half of the trade. And from where I come from, half is a good start.
We will watch this process with great interest, Ambassador Ochoa promised.
Cutting the income of the drug traffickers by that much would reduce their ability to buy protection, and help his government do what it had so earnestly tried to do, for the monetary power of the drug trade was a political cancer in the body of his country.
I regret the circumstances that brought this meeting about, but I am glad that we've had a chance to discuss the issues.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador, for being so forthright. I want you to know that I am always open to any exchange of views. Most of all, I want you and your government to know that I have great respect for the rule of law, and that respect does not stop at our borders. Whatever may have happened in the past, I propose a new beginning, and I will back up my words with action.
Both men stood, and Ryan took his hand again and led him outside.
There followed a few minutes on the edge of the Rose Garden in front of some TV cameras. The White House press office would release a statement about a friendly meeting between the two men. The photos would run on the news to show that it might not be a lie.
"It promises to be a good spring," Ochoa said, noting the clear sky and warming breezes.
"But summers here can be very unpleasant. Tell me, what's it like in Bogota?"
"We are high up. It's never terribly hot, but the sun can be punishing."
"Well, this is a fine garden. My wife loves flowers."
"She's becoming famous," the ambassador said. "She's developed her own new type of rose. Somehow she crossbred yellow and pink and produced something that's almost golden in color."
"What does she call it?"
Ryan's entire knowledge of roses was that you had to be careful about the branches or stalks or whatever you called the thorny part, but the cameras were rolling.
"In English it would be Don Display. All the good names for roses, it seems, have already been taken," Ochoa noted with a friendly smile.
"Perhaps we might have some for the garden here?"
"Maria would be greatly honored, Mr. President."
"Then we have more than one agreement, senor." Another handshake.
Ochoa knew the game, too. For the cameras, his Latin face broke into the friendliest of diplomatic smiles. But the handshake also had genuine warmth in it.
"Don Display. For a truly new day between us, Mr. President.
My word on it."
And they took their leave. Ryan walked back into the West Wing. Arnie was waiting inside the door. It was widely known but little acknowledged that the Oval Office was wired like a pinball machine, or more properly, a recording studio.
"You're learning. You're really learning," the chief of staff observed.
"That one was easy, Arnie. We've been fucking those people over for too long. All I had to do was tell the truth. I want that legislation fast-tracked. When will the draft be ready?"
"Couple of weeks."
"It's going to raise some hell," Van Damme warned.
"I don't care," the president replied.
"How about we try something that might work instead of spending money for show all the time? We've tried shooting the planes down. We've tried murder. We've tried interdiction. We've tried going after pushers. We've exhausted all the other possibilities, and they don't work because there's too much money involved for people not to give it a go. How about we go after the source of the problem for a change? That's where the problem starts, and that's where the money comes from."
"I'm just telling you, it's going to be hard."
"What useful thing isn't?" Ryan asked, heading back to his office. Instead of the direct door off the corridor, he went through the secretary's room.
"Ellen," he said, gesturing to the Oval Office.
"Am I corrupting you?" Mrs. Sumter asked, bringing her cigarettes, to the semi-concealed smiles of the other ladies in the room.
"Kathy might see it that way, but we don't have to tell her, do we?"
In the sanctity of his office, the President of the United States lit up a skinny woman's cigarette, celebrating with one addiction an attack on another. And, oh, by the way, having neutralized a potential diplomatic earthquake. The last of the travelers left America, strangely enough, from Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport, via Northwest and KLM flights. But Ryan would sweat it out for hours more. In the interest of security, none of them had so much as a telephone number to call to announce success, warn of failure, or to give to whomever might have arrested them, tying them to the UIR with something more than their own words. Instead, Bedrein had people at all of the return airports with flight schedules. When the travelers got off their flights in Europe and were visually recognized, then calls would be made circuitously, from public phones, using prepaid and anonymous calling cards. The successful return of the travelers to Tehran would start the next operation. Sitting in an office there, Bedrein had nothing more to do than look at the clock and worry. He was logged onto the net via his computer, and had been scanning the news wires and finding nothing of note. Nothing would be certain until all the travelers got back and made their individual reports. Not even then, really. It would take 3 or 4 days, maybe 5, before the email lines to CDC would be screaming. Then he'd know. Chapter 39. FaceTime. The flight across the pond was pleasant. The VC-20B was more a mini-airliner than a business jet, and the Air Force crewmen, who looked to Clark as though they might be old enough to take driving lessons, kept things smooth. The aircraft began its descent into the enveloping darkness of the European night, finally landing at a military airfield west of Paris. There was no arrival ceremony, per se, but Adler was an official of ministerial rank, and he had to be met, even on a covert mission. In this case, a high-level official, a civil servant, walked up to the aircraft as soon as the engines wound down. Adler recognized him as the stairs descended.
"Claude!"
"Scott, congratulations on your promotion, my old friend."
In deference to American tastes, kisses were not exchanged. Clark and Chavez scanned the area for danger, but all they saw were French troops, or maybe police. They couldn't tell at this distance, standing in a circle, with weapons in evidence. Europeans had a penchant for showing people machine guns, even on city streets. It probably had a salutary effect on street muggings, John thought, but it seemed a little excessive. In any case, they'd expected no special dangers in France, and indeed there were none. Adler and his friend got in an official vehicle. Clark and Chavez got in the chase car. The flight crew would head off for mandated crew rest, which was U.S. Air Force talk for having a few with their French colleagues.
"We go to the lounge for a few minutes before your aircraft is ready," a French Air Force colonel explained. "Perhaps you wish to freshen up?"
"Merci, mon commandant," Ding replied.
Yeah, he thought, the Frenchies do know how to make you feel safe.
"Thank you for helping to arrange this," Adler said to his friend. They'd been FSOs together, once in Moscow and once more in Pretoria. Both had specialized in sensitive assignments.
"It is nothing, Scott."
Which it wasn't, but diplomats talk like diplomats even when they don't have to. Claude had once helped him get through a divorce in a uniquely French way, all the while speaking as though conducting treaty negotiations. It was almost a joke between the two.
"Our ambassador reports that he will be receptive to the right sort of approach."
"And what might that be?" Sextate asked his colleague.
They got out at what appeared to be the base officers' club, and a minute later found themselves in a private dining room with a carafe of fine Beaujolais on the table.
"What's your take on this, Claude? What does Darii want?"
The shrug was as much a part of the French character as the wine which Claude poured. They toasted, and the wine was superb even by the standards of the French diplomatic service. Then came business.
"We are not sure. We wonder about the death of the Turkoman premier."
"You don't wonder about the death of—"
"I do not believe anyone has doubts about that, Scott. But that is a long-standing business, is it not?"
"Not exactly."
Another sip.
"Claude, you're still the best authority on wine I know."
"What's he thinking about?"
"Probably many things.
His domestic troubles.
You Americans don't appreciate them as well as you should."
"His people are restless. Less so now that he's conquered Iraq, but the problem is still there. We feel that he must consolidate before he does anything else. We also feel that the process may turn out to be unsuccessful."
"We are hopeful, Scott.
We are hopeful that the extreme aspects of the regime will moderate over time. Perhaps not very much time.
It must. It is no longer the 8th century, even in that part of the world."
Adler took a few seconds to consider that, then nodded thoughtfully.
"Hope you're right. The guy's always scared me."
"All men are mortal. He is 72 and he works a hard schedule. In any case, we have to check on him, do we not? If he moves, then we will move together, as we have done in the past. The Saudis and we have talked on this matter also. They are concerned, but not overly so. Our assessment is the same. We counsel you to keep an open mind."
Claude might be correct, Adler thought. Darii was old, and consolidating the rule over a newly acquired country wasn't exactly a trivial undertaking. More than that, the easiest way to bring a hostile country down, if you have the patience for it, was to be nice to the bastards. A little trade, a few journalists, some CNN, and a couple of G-rated movies, Such things could do wonders. If you have the patience. If you had the time. There were plenty of Iranian kids in American universities. That could be the most effective means for America to change the UIR. Problem was, Daryai had to know that too. And so here he was, Scott Adler, Secretary of State, a post he'd never expected to approach, much less have, and he was supposed to know what to do next. But he'd read enough diplomatic history to know better. "I'll listen to what he has to say, and we're not looking to make any new enemies, Claude. I think you know that."
"D'accord."
He topped off Adler's glass.
"Unfortunately, you will find none of this in Tehran.
And two is my limit when I'm working."
"Your flight crew is excellent," Claude assured him. "They fly our own ministers."
"When has your hospitality ever been lacking?" For Clark and Chavez, it was Perrier. Cheaper to buy here, they both imagined, though the lemons probably were not. "So how are things in Washington?" a French counterpart asked, just killing time, or so it seemed.
"Pretty strange.
You know, it's amazing how quiet the country is. Maybe having a lot of the government turned off helps," John said, trying to dodge.
"And this talk of your president and his adventures?"
"Sounds like a lot of movie stuff to me," Ding said, with the open face of honesty. "Stealing a Russian sub? All by himself? Damn," Clark grinned. "I wonder who made that up."
"But the Russian spy chief," their host objected, "it is he, and he's been on the television."
"Yeah, well, I bet we paid him a ton of money to come across, too."
"Probably wants to do a book and make some more," Chavez laughed. "Some bitch'll get it, too. Hey, mon ami, we're just worker bees, okay?"
It didn't fly any better than a lead glider. Clark looked into their interrogator's eyes, and they just clicked. The man was DGSE, and he knew agency when he saw it.
"Then be careful of the nectar you will find where you are going, my young friend. It is, perhaps, too sweet."
It was like the start of a card game. The deck was out, and he was shuffling. Probably just one hand, and maybe a friendly one, but the hand had to be played.
"What do you mean?"
"The man you go to meet, he is dangerous. He has the look of one who sees what we do not."
"You've worked the country?" John asked.
"I have traveled through the country, yes."
"And?" This was Chavez.
"And I have never understood them."
"Yeah," Clark agreed, "I know what you're saying."
"An interesting man, your president," the Frenchman said again, and it was pure curiosity, actually an endearing thing to see in the eyes of an intelligence officer.
John looked right in those eyes and decided to thank the man for his warning, one pro to another.
"Yeah, he is.
He's one of us," Clark assured him.
"And those entertaining stories?"
"I cannot say." Delivered with a smile. "Of course they're true. You think reporters have the wit to make such things up?" Both men were thinking the same thing, and both men knew it, though neither could speak it aloud. A shame we cannot get together some evening for a dinner and some stories. But it just wasn't done.
"On the way back, I will offer you a drink."
"On the way back, I will have it." Ding just listened and watched. The old bastard still had it, and there were still lessons to learn from how he did it.
"Nice to have a friend," he said 5 minutes later on the way to the French aircraft.
"Better than a friend, a pro. You listen to people like him, Domingo."
Nobody had ever said that governance was easy, even for those who invoked the word of God for nearly everything. The disappointment, even for Daryai, who'd been governing Iran for nearly 20 years in one capacity or another, was in all the petty administrative rubbish that reached his desk and took from his time. He'd never grasped that it was almost entirely his fault. His rule was fair by his own reckoning, but harsh by most others. Most violations of the rules mandated death for the miscreant, and even small administrative errors on the part of bureaucrats could entail the end of a career. That degree of mercy depended on the magnitude of the error, of course.
A bureaucrat who said no to everything, noting that the law was clear on an issue, whether it was or not, rarely got into trouble. One who broadened the scope of the government's power over the most minor of day-to-day activities was merely adding to the scope of Daryai's rule. Such decisions came easily and caused little in the way of difficulty to the arbiter in question. But real life wasn't that simple. Practical questions of commerce, for example, just the way in which the country did business in everything from the sale of melons to the honking of auto horns around a mosque, required a certain degree of judgment. Because the Holy Quran hadn't anticipated every situation, and neither had the civil law been based upon it. But to liberalize anything was a major undertaking, because any liberalization of any rule might be seen as a theological error. This in a country where apostasy was a capital crime. And so the lowest-level bureaucrats, when stuck with the necessity of saying yes to a request from time to time, tended to hem and haw and kick things upstairs, which gave a higher-level official the chance to say no, which came just as easily to them after a career of doing so, but with somewhat greater authority, somewhat greater responsibility, and far more to lose in the event that someone higher still disagreed with the rare and erroneous yes decision. All that meant was that such calls kept perking up the pyramid. In between Daryai and the bureaucracy was a council of religious leaders. He'd been a member under Khomeini, and a titular parliament, and experienced officials. But, disappointingly to the new UIR's religious leader, the principle held, and he found himself dealing with such weighty issues as the business hours for markets, the price of petrol, and the educational syllabus of grade school females. The sour expression he'd adopted for such trivial issues merely made his lesser colleagues all the more obsequious in their presentation of the pros and cons, which added an additional measure of gravity to the absurd, while they sought favor for being strict, opposing whatever change was on the table, or for being practical, supporting it. Earning Daryai's favor was the biggest political game in town, and he inevitably found himself as tied down as an insect in amber by small issues, while he needed all his time to deal with the big ones. The amazing part is that he never understood why people couldn't take some initiative, even as he destroyed people on occasion for taking any. So it was that he landed in Baghdad this evening to meet with local religious leaders. The issue of the day was which mosque in need of repair would get repaired first. It was known that Mahmud Haji had one personal favorite for his own prayers, another for its architectural beauty, and yet a third for its great historical significance, while the people of the city loved yet another. And wouldn't it be a better idea, politically, to deal with the maintenance needs of that one first, the better to ensure the political stability of the region? After that came a problem with the right of women to drive cars. The previous Iraqi regime had been overly liberal on that, which was objectionable. But was it not difficult to take away a right already possessed? And what of women who lacked a man, widows, for example, to drive them, and also lacked the money with which to hire one? Should the government look after their needs? Some, physicians for one example, teachers for another, were important to the local society. On the other hand, since Iran and Iraq were now one, the law had to be the same. And so did one grant a right to Iranian women or deny it to the Iraqi. For these weighty issues and a few others, he had to take an evening flight to Baghdad. Daryai, sitting in his private jet, looked over the agenda for the meeting and wanted to scream, but he was too patient a man for that, or so he told himself. He had something important to prepare for, after all. In the morning he'd be meeting with the Jew-American foreign minister. His expression, as he looked through the papers, frightened even the flight crew, though Mahmud Haji didn't notice that, and even if he had, would not have understood why. Why couldn't people take some initiative? The jet was a Dassault Falcon 900B, about 9 years old, similar in basic type and function to the U.S. Air Force VC-20B twin jet. The two-man flight crew was a pair of French Air Force officers,
both rather senior for this charter. And there was also a pair of cabin attendants, both female and as charming as they could be. At least one, Clark figured, was a DGSE spook. Maybe both. He liked the French, especially their intelligence services. As troublesome an ally as France occasionally was, when the French did business in the black world, they damned well did business as well as any and better than most. Fortunately, in the case at hand, aircraft are noisy and hard to bug. Perhaps that explained why one attendant or the other would come back every 15 minutes or so to ask if they needed anything.
"Anything special we need to know?" John asked, when the latest offer was declined with a smile.
"Not really," Adler replied. "We want to get a feel for the guy, what he's up to. My friend Claude back at Paris says that things are not as bad as they look, and his reasoning seems pretty sound. Mainly, I'm delivering the usual message."
"Behave yourself," Chavez said with a smile. The Secretary of State smiled. "Somewhat more diplomatically, but yes. What's your background, Mr. Chavez?"
Clark liked that one. "You don't want to know where we got him from."
"I just finished my master's thesis," the young spook said proudly. "Get hooded in June."
"Where?"
"George Mason University, Professor Alpher."
That perked Adler's interest.
"Really? She used to work for me. What's the thesis on?"
"It's called A Study in Conventional Wisdom, Erroneous Diplomatic Maneuvers in Turn-of-the-Century Europe."
"The Germans and the Brits?"
Ding nodded.
"Mainly, especially the naval races."
"Your conclusion?"
"People couldn't recognize the differences between tactical and strategic goals. The guys supposed to be thinking future were thinking right now instead. Because they confused politics with statecraft, they ended up in a war that brought down the entire European order and replaced it with nothing more than scar tissue."
It was remarkable, Clark thought, listening to the brief discourse, that Ding's voice changed when discussing his schoolwork.
"And you're an SPO?" Sextate asked, with a certain degree of incredulity.
A very Latino grin reappeared.
"Used to be. Sorry if I don't drag my knuckles on the ground like I'm supposed to, sir."
"So why did Ed Foley lay you two on me?"
"My fault," Clark said. "They want us to take a little stroll around and get a smell for things."
"Your fault?" Scott asked.
"I was their training officer once upon a time," John explained, "and that changed the complexion of the conversation entirely."
"You're the guys who got Koga out. You're the guys who..."
"Yeah, we were there," Chavez confirmed. Sextate was probably cleared for all that.
"Lots of fun."
The Secretary of State told himself that he should be offended that he had two field spooks with him, and the younger one's remark about being a knuckle-dragger wasn't that far off. But a master's from George Mason.
"You're also the guys who sent that report that Brett Hansen poo-pooed. The one about Goto. That was good work. In fact, it was excellent work."
He'd wondered what these two were doing on the SNI team for the UIR situation. Now he knew.
"But nobody listened," Chavez pointed out.
It may have been a deciding factor in the war with Japan, and a very hairy time for them in that country. But it had also given him some real insight into how diplomacy and statecraft hadn't changed very much since 1905. It was an ill wind that blew no one good.
"I'll listen," Adler promised. "Let me know what your little stroll turns up, okay?"
"Sure will."
"I guess you have need to know on this," John observed, with a raised eyebrow.
Adler turned and waved to one of the attendants, the pretty brunette one, whom Clark had tagged as a certain spook. She was just as charming as hell and drop-dead pretty, but seemed a little too clumsy in the galley to be a full-time flight attendant.
"Yes, Monsieur Minister."
"How long until we land?"
4 hours.
"Okay, then, could we have a deck of cards and a bottle of wine?"
"Certainly."
She hustled the 12 feet to get them.
"Not supposed to drink on duty, sir," Chavez said.
"You're off duty until we land," Adler told them. "And I like to play cards before I go into one of these sessions. Good for the nerves."
"You gentlemen up to a friendly game?"
"Well, Mr. Secretary, if you insist," John replied. Now they'd all get a read on the mission. A little 5-card stud, maybe?
Everybody knew where the line was. No official communiques had been exchanged, at least not between Beijing and Taipei, but it was known and understood even so, because people in uniform tend to be practical and observant. The PRC aircraft never flew closer than 10 nautical miles, 15 kilometers, to a certain north-south line, and the ROC aircraft, recognizing that fact, kept the same distance from the same invisible bit of longitude. On either side of the line, people could do anything they wanted, appear as aggressive as they wished, expend all the ordnance they could afford. And that was agreed to without so much as a single tactical radio message. It was all in the interest of stability. Playing with loaded guns was always dangerous, as much so for nation-states as for children, though the latter were more easily disciplined. The former were too big for that. America now had 4 submarines in the Formosa Strait. These were spotted on, under, the invisible line, which was the safest place to be. A further collection of 3 ships was now at the north end of the passage, a cruiser, USS Port Royal, along with destroyers, the Sullivans and Chandler. All were SAM ships, equipped with a total of 250 SM-2MR missiles. Ordinarily, they were tasked to guard a carrier from air attack, but their carrier was in Pearl Harbor, having her engines replaced. Port Royal and the Sullivans, named for a family of sailors wiped out on the same ship in 1942, were both Aegis ships with powerful spy radars, which were now surveilling air activity while the submarines were handling the rest. Chandler had a special Eland team aboard to keep track of voice radio transmissions. Like a cop on the beat, they were not so much there to interfere with anyone's exercises as to let people know that the law was around, in a friendly sort of way, and as long as they were, things would not get out of hand. At least that was the idea. And if anyone objected to the presence of the American ships, their country would note that the seas were free for the innocent passage of all, and they weren't in anyone's way, were they? That they were actually part of someone else's plan was not immediately apparent to anyone. What happened next confused nearly everyone. It was dawn in the air, if not yet on the surface, when a flight of 4 PRC fighters came off the mainland, heading east, followed 5 minutes later by 4 more. These were duly tracked by the American ships at the extreme range of their billboard radars. Routine track numbers were assigned, and the computer system followed their progress to the satisfaction of the officers and men in the CIC of Port Royal. Until they didn't turn. Then a lieutenant lifted a phone and pushed a button. "Yes," a groggy voice answered. "Captain, combat, we have a flight of PRC aircraft, probably fighters, about to cross the line, bearing 210, altitude 15,000, course 090, speed 500. There's a flight of 4 more a few minutes behind." "On the way." The captain, partially dressed, arrived in the combat information center 2 minutes later, not in time to see the PRC fighters break the rules, but in time to hear a petty officer report something. "New track, 4 or more fighters coming west." For the purposes of convenience, the computer had been told to assign enemy designator graphics to the mainland fighters and friendly symbols to the Taiwanese. There were also a few American aircraft around from time to time, but these were electronic intelligence gatherers and well out of harm's way. At this point, there were 2 immediately converging flights of 4 each, about 30 miles apart, but with a closure speed of over 1,000 miles per hour. The radar was also tracking 6 commercial airliners, all on the east side of the line, minding their own business as they skirted the agreed-upon exercise areas. "Raid 6 is turning," a sailor reported next. This was the first outbound flight off the mainland, and as the captain watched, the velocity vector turned southward, while the outbound flight off Taiwan bored in on them. "Illuminators coming on," the chief at the ESM console said. "The ROCs are lighting up Raid 6. Their radar seemed to be in tracking mode."
Maybe that's why they turned, the captain thought. Maybe they got lost, the CIC officer wondered. Still dark out. Maybe they just went too far. They didn't know what sort of navigation gear the Chi-Com fighters might have had, and driving a single-seat aircraft over the sea at night was not a precise business. More airborne radars coming on, easterly direction probably Raid 7, the ESM chief said. This was the second flight off the mainland. Any electronic activity from Raid 6, the CIC officer asked. Negative, sir. These fighters continued their turn and were now heading west, back for the line, with the ROC F-16s in pursuit. It was at this point that things changed. Raid 7 is turning, course now 097. That puts them on the 16s. And they're illuminating, the lieutenant observed, with the first hint of worry in his voice. Raid 7 is lighting up the F-16's radars in tracking mode. The Republic of China F-16s then turned also. They'd been getting a lot of work. The newer American-made fighters and their elite pilots comprised only about a third of their fighter force and were drawing the duty of covering and responding to the flight exercises of their mainland cousins. Leaving Raid 6 to return, they necessarily got more interested in the trailing flight, still heading east. The closure rate was still 1,000 miles per hour, and both sides had their missile-targeting radars up and running, aimed at each other. That was internationally recognized as an unfriendly act, and one to be avoided for the simple reason that it was the aerial equivalent of aiming a rifle at someone's head. "Uh-oh," the petty officer on the ESM board said. "Sir, Raid 7, their radars just shifted to tracking mode." Instead of just searching for targets, the airborne systems were now operating in the manner used to guide air-to-air missiles. What had been merely unfriendly a few seconds ago now became overtly hostile. The F-16s broke into two pairs, elements, and began maneuvering freely. The outbound PRC fighters did the same. The original flight of four, Raid 6, was now across the line, heading west on what appeared to be a direct line to their airfield. "Oh, I think I know what's going on here, sir. Look how—" A very small pip appeared on the screen, leaving one of the ROC F-16s. "Oh, shit," a sailor said. "We have a missile in the air." "Make that two," his chief said. Aloft, a pair of American-made AIM-120 missiles were now taking separate paths to separate targets. "They thought it was an attack. Oh, Christ," the captain said, turning to his communications. "Get me sync pack right now." It didn't take long. One of the mainland fighters turned into a puff on the screen. Warned, the other jinked hard and dodged its missile at the last second. Then it turned back. The southern PRC fighter element maneuvered also, and Raid 6 turned radically to the north, its illumination radars now on. 10 seconds later, six more missiles were airborne and tracking targets. "We got a battle on our hands," the chief of the watch said. The captain lifted the phone. "Bridge, combat, general quarters, general quarters." Then he grabbed the TBS microphone, getting the captains of his two companion ships, both 10 miles away, east and west of his cruiser, as the alarm gong started sounding on USS Port Royal. "I have it," the Sullivans reported. That destroyer was outboard. "Me too," Chandler chimed in. That one was closer to the island nation, but getting the radar picture from the Aegis ships via data link. "That's a kill!" Another Chi-Com fighter took its hit and headed down to the still dark surface. 5 seconds later, an F-16 died. More crewmen arrived in CIC taking their battle stations. "Captain, Raid 6 was just trying to simulate—" "Yeah, I see that now, but we have a train wreck on our hands." And then, predictably, a missile went wild. These were so small as to be hard for the Aegis radar to track. But a technician boosted power, throwing 6 million watts of RF energy into the exercise area, and the picture became more clear. "Oh, shit," a chief said, pointing to the main tactical display. "Captain, look there." It was instantly obvious. Someone had loosed what was probably an infrared-seeking missile, and the hottest target in town was an Air China Airbus 310, with two huge General Electric CF-6 turbofans, the same basic engines as those which powered all three of the American warships, which looked like the sun to its single red eye. "Chief Albertson, get him on guard," the skipper shouted.
Air China 666, this is a U.S. Navy warship. You have a missile inbound on you from the northwest. I say again, maneuver immediately. You have a missile tracking you from the northwest. What? What? But the plane started moving, turning left and descending. Not that it mattered. The plotted velocity vector of the missile never wavered from the target. There was a hope that it would burn out and fall short, but the missile was going at Mach 3, and the Air China flight was already slowed down, commencing its approach to its home field. When the pilot put his nose down, he just made things easier for the missile. "It's a big airplane," the captain said. "Only two engines, sir," the weapons officer pointed out. "That's a hit," a radar man said. "Get her down, pal, get her down." "Oh, fuck," the captain breathed, wanting to turn away. On the display, the 310's blip tripled in size and flashed the emergency code. "He's calling Mayday, sir," a radioman said. "Air China Flight 666 is calling Mayday. Engine and wing damage, possible fire aboard." "Only about 50 miles out," a chief said. "He's vectoring for a direct approach into Taipei." "Captain, all stations report manned and ready. Condition one is set throughout the ship," the IC man of the watch told the skipper. "Very well." His eyes were locked on the center of the three radar displays. The fighter engagement, he saw, had ended as quickly as it had started, with three fighters, splashed, another possibly damaged, and both sides withdrawing to lick their wounds and figure out what the hell had happened. On the Taiwanese side, another flight of fighters was up and forming just off their coast. "Captain," it was the ESM console, "looks like every radar on every ship just lit off. Sources all over the place, classifying them now." But that didn't matter, the captain knew. What mattered now was that Airbus 310 was slowing and descending, according to his display. "Sync pack operation, sir," the radio chief pointed. "This is Port Royal," the captain said, lifting the phone-type receiver for the satellite radio link. "We just had a little air battle here, and a missile went wild, and it appears that it hit an airliner inbound from Hong Kong to Taipei. The aircraft is still in the air, but looks to be in trouble. We have two Chi-Com MiGs and one Rock F-16 splashed, maybe one more 16 damaged." "Who started it?" the watch officer asked. "We think the Rock pilots fired the first missile. It could have been a screw-up." He explained on for a few seconds. "I'll upload our radar take as quick as I can." "Very well, thank you, Captain. I'll pass that along to the boss. Please keep us informed." "Will do." The skipper killed the radio link and turned to the IC man of the watch. "Let's get a tape of the battle set up for uplinking to Pearl." "Aye, sir." Air China 666 was still heading toward the coast, but the radar track showed the aircraft snaking and yawing around its straight-line course into Taipei. The ELINT team on Chandler was now listening in on the radio circuits. English is the language of international aviation, and the pilot in command of the wounded airliner was speaking quickly and clearly, calling ahead for emergency procedures, while he and his co-pilot struggled with their wounded airliner. Only they, really, knew the magnitude of the problem. Everyone else was just a spectator, rooting and praying that he'd keep it together for another 15 minutes. This one went up the line fast. The communications nexus was Admiral David Seaton's office on the hilltop overlooking Pearl Harbor. The senior communications watch officer changed buttons on his phone to call the theater commander-in-chief, who immediately told him to shoot a critic-level flash message to Washington. Seaton next ordered an alert message to the 7 American warships in the area, mainly the submarines, to perk their ears up. After that, a message went off to the Americans who were observing the exercise in various Republic of China military command posts. These would take time to get delivered. There was still no American embassy in Taipei, and therefore no attachés or CIA personnel to hustle down to the airport to see if the airliner made it in safely or not. At that point, there was nothing to do but wait, in anticipation of the questions that would start arriving from Washington, and which, as yet, he was in no real position to answer. "Yes," Ryan said, lifting the phone. "Dr. Goodley for you, sir." "Okay, put him on." Pause. "Ben, what is it?" "Trouble off Taiwan, Mr. President. Could be a bad one." The National Security Advisor explained on, telling what he knew. It didn't take long.
It was, on the whole, an impressive exercise in communications. The Airbus was still in the air, and the President of the United States knew that there was a problem, and nothing else.
Okay, keep me posted.
Ryan looked down at the desk he was about to leave.
Oh, shit.
It was such a pleasure, the power of the presidency. Now he had virtually instant knowledge of something he could do nothing about. Were there Americans on the aircraft? What did it all mean? What was happening? It could have been worse. Daryai got back on the aircraft after having been in Baghdad for less than 4 hours, having dealt with the problems even more tersely than usual, and taking some satisfaction from the fear he'd struck into a few hearts for having bothered him with such trivial matters. His sour stomach contributed to an even more sour expression as he boarded and found his seat, and waved to the attendant to tell the flight crew to get moving. The sort of wrist-snapping gesture that looked like off with their heads to so many. 30 seconds later, the stairs were up and the engines turning.
"Where did you learn this game?" Adler asked.
"In the Navy, Mr. Secretary," Clark answered, collecting the pot. He was $10 up now, and it wasn't the money. It was the principle of the thing. He'd just bluffed the Secretary of State out of $2. Miller time.
"I thought sailors were crummy gamblers."
"That's what some people say." Clark smiled as he piled the quarters up.
"Watch his hands," Chavez advised.
"I am watching his hands." The attendant came aft and poured out the rest of the wine. Not even 2 full glasses for the men, just enough to pass the time.
"Excuse me, how much longer?"
"Less than an hour, Monsieur Minister."
"Thank you."
Adler smiled at her as she moved back forward.
"King bets, Mr. Secretary," Clark told him.
Chavez checked his hole card. Pair of fives. "Nice start." He tossed a quarter into the center of the table after Adler's. The European-made Airbus 310 had lost its right-side engine to the missile, but that wasn't all. The heat-seeker had come in from the right rear and impacted on the side of the big GE turbofan, with fragments from the explosion ripping into the outboard wing panels. Some of these sliced into a fuel cell, fortunately almost empty, which trailed some burning fuel, panicking those who could look out their windows and see. But that wasn't the frightening part. Fire behind the aircraft couldn't hurt anyone, and the vented fuel tank didn't explode, as it might have done had it been hit as little as 10 minutes earlier. The really bad news was the damage to the aircraft's control surfaces. Forward, the 2-man flight crew was as experienced as that of any international airline. The Airbus could fly quite well, thank you, on one engine, and the left-side engine was undamaged, and now turning at full power, while the co-pilot shut down the right side of the aircraft and punched the manual controls on the elaborate fire suppression systems. In seconds, the fire warning alarms went silent, and the co-pilot started breathing again. "Elevator damage," the pilot reported next, working the controls and finding that the Airbus wasn't responding as it should. But the problem wasn't with the flight crew, either. The Airbus actually flew via computer software, a huge executive program that took inputs directly from the airframe as well as from the control movements of the pilots, analyzed them, and then told the control surfaces what to do next. Battle damage was not something the software engineers had anticipated in the design of the aircraft. The program noted the traumatic loss of the engine and decided it was an engine explosion, which it had been taught to think about. The onboard computers evaluated the damage to the aircraft, what control surfaces worked and how well, and adjusted itself to the situation. 20 miles, the co-pilot reported, as the Airbus settled in on its direct penetration vector. The pilot adjusted his throttle, and the computers, the aircraft actually had 7 of them, decided this was all right, and lowered engine power. The aircraft, having burned off most of its fuel, was light. They had all the engine power they needed. The altitude was low enough that depressurization was not an issue. They could steer. They just might make this, they decided.
A helpful fighter aircraft pulled alongside to look over their damage and tried to call them on the guard frequency, only to be told to keep out of the way in very irate Mandarin. The fighter could see skin peeling off the Airbus and tried to report that, only to be rebuffed. His F-5E backed off to observe, talking to his base all the while.